This is the Barbarian Rhetoric Podcast. Acta non verba.
Welcome, Mark, and to the Barbarian Rhetoric, and it's going to be fun. This is another New Zealander friend. Some of you guys have heard me speak with Graham Smith, so welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And then tell us a little bit about yourself, because you shared some in FOE, and you got me excited because I like talking to smart men.
Yeah, so with my background, as you said, I'm a New Zealander. I'm 40 years old, and I went on a journey probably about 20 years ago, looking to sort of re-steer my career. I left school young and did lots of different jobs, and ended up getting into the marine science field, and studied in marine science and environmental sciences for about 7 years, and graduated with a master's degree from University of Auckland. And then moved into environmental consulting. And since then, I've been working with businesses around the world, predominantly in New Zealand, but also Australia, and with their interests up in Asia Pacific, helping businesses manage their environmental impacts. For the last year, I've taken a bit of a shift. So I've moved away from the consulting sector, and now I'm working for a government agency in the conservation field. So similar to Parks and Wildlife in America. Looking after our national parks and specifically working with the management of endangered species. So species that are right on their last legs, there might only be a few hundred of them left, and working with teams of people to figure out how to prevent them from going extinct and hopefully recover their populations. So, that's my background. I guess I came into the environmental field with a background in business and sales and management, then re-educated into science, and then moved into consulting. And so that blend assisted me in really working alongside businesses to think differently about the way they operated, and to be able to take the science speak and convert it into something that was understandable for clients, and then work with them to perhaps have a bit of a lighter footprint. Yeah.
And I can understand that coming from the trade side and everything. Sometimes you get the bean counters or someone come in and they're talking to you in such technical terms, and you almost need the interpreter to go, this is what you guys need to do. And you're like, oh, okay. Yeah. Why didn't you just say that?
That's exactly right, mate. That's exactly right. Often with business, it's less about what it is that you need to do that is the concern in and of itself, and more about managing the uncertainty associated with what you need to do. And within the environmental space, there's often an enormous amount of uncertainty, be it, I don't know, a large oil and gas firm coming in from Houston to New Zealand wanting to drill an offshore deep water well. And at the time when this occurred for me, regulation was just kicking off in New Zealand. So the government agency had a whole lot of uncertainty. They weren't really sure how to utilize this new regulation. We had this company from Houston that was coming in. They didn't necessarily know how to interact. So the world of me as a consultant was playing the middleman and working with both parties to unpick that uncertainty and communicate with both sides to really identify what the needs were and find that middle ground. And I really enjoy that space. I really do. I like talking with people. I like tossing around ideas and eventually landing in a common ground.
And that opens up to a lot of interesting things, and something we were chatting back and forth a little bit. Let's get into some of the myths. You know, you talked about offshore coming in or other things, environmental things. What are some of the stuff that is still commonly believed that's just a straight up myth? You know, worldwide, New Zealander, anything along that lines.
Sure. Look, mate, one of the biggest myths that I find is still perpetuated is, and I think it's inherent in our culture today, is this concept of mass division. And there seems to be a perception that pervades society outside of the environmental and business circles, and I guess big business circles, that businesses really dislike environmental management, and that environmentalists really dislike business. And it's a straight out myth. And I can provide numerous examples, and I'll give you one just to kick us off a bit. So one of the biggest, I won't name names, but one of the biggest oil and gas businesses in the world decided to explore offshore in New Zealand. And they wanted to drill some exploratory wells, deepwater wells. And as I just pointed out, we had some new regulation in New Zealand at the time. And we were working as a consultant, I was working with our government agencies to establish what it was that was required of this company to do what it was that they wanted to do. And so there was a series of months of work that we went through to figure all of this out, because the government agency was trying to wrap their head around it at the time too. And when we actually sat down around table with my client and looked at it, their own corporate expectations, what it was that they as a business wanted to undertake before they proceeded and drilled a well, exceeded that of the regulation. So to go through the approvals process within their own organization, they were going to have to do more than what the government was asking them to do. So that was example number one. Example number two was another significant offshore oil and gas company that came into New Zealand. They looked at some of the requirements for seismic surveys. So seismic surveys is when they take a boat out offshore, they utilize sound to map the potential of hydrocarbons underneath the seafloor. Where is the oil or gas? So we're mapping it.
Okay.
And because it emits a lot of sound, big booms, it impacts on marine mammals, dolphins, whales, and other marine life as well. So you have to manage that. One of the ways of managing it is having people on your boat looking out for dolphins and whales. And if you see them, then there's a series of procedures that you undertake. Now, this company opted to, through their own desire to have corporate responsibility, to double the number of people on the boat that were looking for the dolphins and the whales. And that was the decision that they made. It wasn't required of them. It was the decision they made. And I've seen examples of this over and over and over again. In New Zealand, most recently, we had some regulation passed. It seeks to make New Zealand carbon neutral by 2050. So that means that our collective greenhouse gas emissions, all the pollutants that go into the atmosphere, if you like, pollutants is probably the wrong word, but gases that go into the atmosphere that could exacerbate climate change are no greater than what our country removes out of the atmosphere through sequestration. So there's an overall balance, okay. Net balance. Yeah. And there were a group of companies that came together. They formed the Sustainable Business Council a long time ago, and they subsequently formed the Climate Leaders Coalition. And when I'm talking about companies, I'm talking about some of the larger companies in New Zealand, like Air New Zealand, one of larger airlines in the world, Fonterra, the world's largest dairy company, and others. And they, and when I say others, there was, I can't remember the exact number, but it was something like 119 of them. And some of the statements they have in their position that they put forward to the government in 2019 was that they are committed to the Paris Agreement target to keep warming below 2 degrees, and to further pursue efforts to limit the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees. That as companies, as businesses, it says here, I'll read it verbatim, we are acting on climate change now to create a future that is low emissions, positive for our businesses and the economy, and inclusive for all New Zealanders. I mean, these are companies that are doing this on their own.
So, I'm curious here. So on something like this, a lot of these major companies are spearheading what could end up becoming even better regulations for the government side later on and improving there. So where does the bad taste come? Is it from stuff that was in the past that before we knew like some of this, like let's say we drop back to the industrial age, was it, we just didn't have the knowledge and we're still holding on to what we learned from back then? Why do people hold on to this thinking that the companies aren't working to improve? Or is there like a bad apple here and there, and then that's what gets blown up in media? Why does it perpetuate?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. Absolutely, there are some bad apples, and so in New Zealand, farming is one of our biggest sectors, and farming can have an impact on the environment in a number of different ways. And we don't need to go into the detail to talk about this as an example. There are some farmers who put in a lot of effort. There are a lot of farmers in New Zealand that put in a lot of effort to minimize their impact on the environment. They're planting trees, they're looking after their waterways, they're measuring water quality, they're being very careful about the amount of fertilizer they put on their farm, et cetera. Constantly looking to improve the way that they look after their land because they believe that they're stewards of the land. They want to pass it on to the next generation in a better way than they took it. But then you'll get a few bad apples. And our good friends in the media will focus in on them and bring them to the table as examples of poor practice. Now, this has positive outcomes and negative outcomes. So the positive outcome is that sometimes there is a general theme among an industry where a standard needs to be raised. And so as a result of the bad apples being brought to the table, awareness gets raised among our communities and standards subsequently lift. And that can be a positive thing. And in my experience, the majority of times where a business is having an impact on the environment, they're doing so because they didn't know. They didn't necessarily understand the impact they were having, and that's particularly true in the farming sector. And as soon as they do understand, they start to make the change that they need to undertake. So really, and you could say it on the flip side too. People like myself, and I'm not a practicing environmental scientist these days. I've moved more into sort of leadership and management. But if we look at environmental scientists at universities and research organizations, they're not necessarily, and in fact, often not the same people that are standing at the protests holding the picket signs, right? They're often different people. But one conflates the two and says, well, if you believe that we should be managing climate change, you're one of those activists. And
okay.
Vice versa. If you believe that profit is a good thing, then you're one of those people that will destroy the environment in order to make your profit. And it's simply not true. And if you bring those people around the table together, often they realize it pretty quickly.
Okay. And that's, yeah, there. Well, and as we often talk about, and especially what's going on in the world, a lot of people aren't willing to sit down at the table anymore and have a discussion. That
Right.
that's becoming a thing of yesteryear. Or yeah, we can agree on 90% and disagree on this little 10%. Okay, that's fair. We're not all robots then. So that makes good sense. So, and really, it comes down just to education, educating both sides to what the other is doing.
That's a big part of it. And I think not generalizing. There's always an inherent danger in and I think that goes into myth number two too, that conservative values can't coexist with environmental management. Again, I just this is not something that I believe to be the case. And we could go down a rabbit hole by starting to talk about the black and white nature of political systems around the world where you're either right or you're left. There's no middle ground, and you can't have, a selection of conservative values with a selection of liberal values that is, I guess, within our narrative, even though logically we understand that's possible, within our narrative, we immediately put people in boxes.
Right.
So even if someone is 80%, 90, let's say they're 99% conservative, if they bring to the table the 1% liberal within their mindset, immediately they're put in the box of you're a liberal and vice versa.
Yes.
We've become so uncomfortable with gray. We've become so uncomfortable with any sort of a middle ground. We have to, and I think part of this, Nate, and again, it's probably a rabbit warren, but part of this is that the world has become so complex because we've got so much information at our fingertips that whenever we can, we seek to simplify.
Yep.
So how can I take this complex equation and make it easy?
Yep. Black and white. A and B.
Yep.
Ones and zeros. Yes. Nuances and gray area. No one wants that area in there. Let's eliminate all of it. And you can't, because that's the largest area. To me, the black and white is the 10%, you know, or the 80-20 rule. 10%'s black, 10%'s white, and then you got 80% that's gray. And that's how I view a lot of things. It gets me in trouble.
Oh, I totally agree with you, though, Nate. I think the majority of the world is that way. And this is something that scientists are inherently comfortable with, because they live in that world of gray. And if we go back to the climate change topic again for a second, there is inherent uncertainty in all of the science that sits behind climate change.
Right.
Because they're using computer models to forecast what may happen under specific circumstances. Now, they seek to calibrate those models as best they can. It's rather than a forecast, it's called a hindcast, where they look to recreate conditions in the past. Then they'll model those conditions and see if it replicates what actually happened. So that's a way that they calibrate their models. And then they try to recreate what may happen in the future based on that calibration, right? But with all of those models, they put an uncertainty ranking. And the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, IPCC, which is the group of scientists that are responsible for pulling together the reports and the guidance the governments turn to around climate change, all of their work has an uncertainty rating. Now, what people will do is zero in on that uncertainty. And I find this fascinating. And they'll zero in on it and say, see, they're uncertain. Therefore, they could be wrong. And because what they're saying is so uncomfortable for me, I'm going to opt to believe that they're wrong.
Okay.
So this is my interpretation of it. I may be completely wrong, and I'm sure I'm not going to generalize. I'm sure it doesn't apply to everyone. But climate change and the actions that are being proposed to mitigate and manage climate change are so significant and in a lot of instances beyond comprehension how big they really are. And they become very emotive. And so accepting that reality is one of the hardest things you can possibly do for a lot of people.
Right. And it's not overnight, you know, it's over a large period of time. You know, you have to be able to look into the future at your generations, your three generations down the road of what's going to happen. You know, it's, hey, if we do this right now, you know, someone like the old school, we used to burn the tires, you know, cook them. That's how we got rid of them. But there was no thought to how's that going to affect our kids or our grandkids or anything. It's, oh, I'm burning a tire. It's you pin down to what's one tire going to hurt anything.
Yeah.
So you have to look large scale and you have to look down through the generational tree and like, what's the future going to behold? You know, we were discussing a little bit. It's like me on my personal thought, just how I read things. I think fossil fuels are going to be around for the next four or five generations. Easy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in that concept, it's like, okay, they're trying to make this other stuff, but it's going to be, but it has to get into the mindset. It's going to help my great, great grandchildren out someday. Not necessarily what we're doing now. For me now, yeah. I'm like, it's like me, I can't stand death. They got DEF on all our diesel engines and it drives me nuts. I think it's a wasted endeavor. I think it causes more hardship than good, but I get it, you know, because it's trying. Is it the right thing? Can they do something better? Does it change stuff? It's still too new. In my opinion, you know, they're still doing testing on it, but we're not going to know for another 20, 30, 40, 50 years or something if that was the right way to go down with diesel engines. And who's doing what with it. So,
yeah. Look, I'll admit I don't know anything about DEF and diesel engines at all, but I think I get the gist of what you're saying. And you know, that's a question of how rapidly are we able to come up with new technologies? And not only that, but how rapidly can we fine tune them, and how rapidly will the market take them up? And this does a bit go back to the environmental business myth, is that there's a lot of people, a lot of successful people out there, and we can use Elon Musk as an example, that are seeing and accept what the scientists are telling them around the likelihood of climate change, and are finding business opportunities in mitigating that potential impact, you know? And that's not to say that there won't be different impacts, right? So, you know, you produce an electric car, that's fantastic. So it doesn't use fossil fuels anymore. And it'll probably last longer because it's got less moving parts and whatever else. But then what do we do about the batteries? You know, how do we source the products that go into the batteries? And so that's a really sound conversation, is to say, well, are we creating another impact by solving this impact? And that a mitigation can cause an impact that you didn't know about, sure. But that's not a reason not to do it.
And an interesting one on the electrical cars, since you brought that up, is you still have to put electric in them. So you still have to generate that electricity. And how is that electricity being generated? So even though you're taking the fuel out of the vehicles, is the fuel just getting transferred over to power plants?
Sure. No, sure. You're 100% correct.
It's a balancing act there.
And so then the next step in the conversation is renewable energy. And we're lucky in New Zealand because we have a small population with a lot of natural resource. So we're 98% renewable, and that the majority of our electricity comes from hydropower, from dams, and from wind. We're starting to move into solar, and we have a bit of top up with coal and looking to phase out that coal. Cool. In other countries, it's a lot more significant than that. I think I was just talking with the father-in-law, and I haven't read up on this, so I apologize if it's wrong, but I believe that Germany have said that they're going to be out of coal by 2030 or 2050 or something like that. It's coming up in the future where they'll be renewable. So renewable electricity is coming. And when you start to put this through the business lens, it's a really interesting concept. Because at the moment, if you think about the whole supply chain of fossil fuels, from finding them, setting up to get them out of the ground, extract them, through to refining them, through to transporting them, through to using them, and then in some instances, disposing of and managing the impacts of disposing them, you think about that whole cost. And then you think about a system, a bigger global system, where it was electricity based, and you imagine that there were solar panels on the roof of your house, and you invested once, and now you've got free electricity, and your car plugs into that, and you invested once, and now you've got free vehicle transport. So the ongoing cost post asset investment is negligible to nil. And so from a business perspective, you could actually increase profits as a result of shifting to a new model. And this is the sort of thinking that's out there at the moment, or I don't profess to be an expert at the moment, or an expert at all. But there are some pretty significantly respected economists out there at the moment. They're talking about, there's a guy called Anthony Rifkin. Is it Anthony Rifkin? Boy, I'm bad with names, Nate, so I've probably got this one wrong, but it's definitely Rifkin. I'm going to look it up here while I'm talking to you. And he talks about the third industrial revolution, which is exactly what we're talking about here. Jeremy Rifkin, apologies. Okay. And literally, like, shifting from being a fossil fuels dependent economy through to a renewable dependent economy. And what does that mean economically for your future as a country? And it is a significant, like, there's a really compelling case there.
Now, okay, I got to stop you a moment, because in my history mind, and I'm showing a weakness here.
Sure.
You said third industrial revolution. So what was the first and second? I am only thinking of one. So what would you consider the first industrial and the second industrial?
Okay.
I'm going to get schooled here, because in my mind, no. I only think of one industrial revolution. So
no, I don't think you're going to get schooled by me, mate. because I don't have that off the top of my head. I think the second one may have been, I'm not going to be able to Google fast enough.
It's all good. Just a general idea.
I can tell you this. What he proposes is that each industrial revolution consisted of three things. One being energy production for, you know, general energy. Two being transport.
Okay.
And three being communication.
All right.
Right. So he said that the industrial revolutions occurred because of those three things. So fossil fuels came into the mix. We were able to create new energy. Transport came about through the internal combustion engine. And then communication came about through telephones, etc. Now what he's saying is we're entering a third industrial revolution. So we have the internet, which is our new form of communication. And you look at the step forward right now. Look at the step forward that we've had since 20 years ago on that, right? Like the massive advances.
Okay, now I'm understanding.
What he's saying is we're going to have energy and transport are going to come alongside as well. And as a result, we're going to have this third industrial revolution. And what he's arguing for the United States in particular, he's saying we need to own this revolution. We need to lead this. And China's ahead of us right now. And he's been... And what he speaks about in his video is that he has been paid for by the Chinese government as a consultant to inform them on how to go about that. And if you think about global competitiveness, where you have one country that has zero ongoing cost, I'm not an economist, so I'm going to murder these terms, but you know, that once you've invested in the infrastructure, you don't have any ongoing cost versus a country that has got constant ongoing cost, who is going to be able to be more competitive? That's his argument.
And I guess
the point of saying all that is not to say the third industrial revolution is correct or that Jeremy Rifkin is correct. That's not my argument. What I'm saying is that there are very astute business people out there who are looking at this and saying, how can we capitalize on this as an opportunity? So again, another myth.
Right.
Capitalism and environmental management don't coexist. That's a total myth. Capitalism is being harnessed to improve environmental management. People are looking at this as an opportunity and saying, I can be more competitive. I can outcompete your brand by saying it's organic. I can outcompete your brand by saying it's got corporate responsibility. And the market wants that. So you can keep doing what you're doing, that's fine. But the competitive edge is now shifting because the market, because the general populace are saying, actually, we want to have a lighter footprint.
Right.
It's interesting.
And something that's interesting that, because I like watching sailing, I watch sailing videos and stuff, and how they're adapting to and using solar. And there's a couple of boats that are getting away from, they're becoming... what's the word? They no longer have a diesel engine. It's all electric. It's all solar panel run. You know, they do have their batteries, but beyond that, it's very environmental friendly. They're not moving the fastest yet. They're not, but they're trying stuff out and the cruisers are doing stuff. And then the other group that I think is interesting is another nomadic crew is the guys that are like going to mini houses or minivans. The off-grid living. And how I look at this is these guys are the test subjects. If we can make such and such panel work and make this work and this can go in there, and it's like, to me, that makes more sense than plugging my electric car in at Shields. it's like, okay, and I had never even thought about it. Okay, one of the big things I always argued with the electric cars is that I saw pointless is, okay, you still have to make the electric. Whichever power plant is pushing it out there. But you're right. If it comes down to, hey, all the roofs now are solar panels instead of shingles, you know, or set it up where the whole top of your house is shingles or the side of your building, you know, city-wise, if they all become some type of solar panel that starts running everything, that's one of those keyholes that may, or keys to it, makes sense.
And free electricity.
And just right out, I can actually sit out on my back porch, and if it's a clear night, I have windmills all the way across my horizon, and I see all the little red lights. There's, I want to say, just in my general county, just to the north of me, there's like 133 of them, and it just lights it all up. And they're all over Illinois here. So it's coming, and I see that, and I hear grumbles, but it's like, okay. But you're making more sense. Make that initial payment. It produces forever.
I'm looking to do it personally with my wife's vehicle, right? She drives a people mover at the moment. And I'm now looking at the cost. And I'm going, you know what? I could get a Nissan Leaf. Well, I've driven it. She's driven it. It's a quick little car. It's safe as hell. It's got 12 airbags. It drives beautifully. It recharges itself when you're braking. So if you're going up and down hills, she has a home range of about 12 to 15 kilometers a day with her get around. So that's fine. And it cost me $1.50 to recharge it, you know? And so I'm looking at it, I'm doing the calculations and going, well, actually we're going to save money across the year by eliminating the cost of gas. And petrol is more expensive in New Zealand than it is in America, granted.
Right.
But nonetheless, once we're looking to get a new home, once we get that new home, I will set it up with the charging point in the garage and sell her people mover and buy her an electric car. Because the cost is going to be so much lower for us. We haven't yet got to the point where by putting solar panels on my roof and having a battery, that'll be cheaper. But it's a whole lot cheaper than it was 5 years ago.
Right.
And in 5 years, it will be cheaper than getting it off the grid, right?
Exactly. And back to my boat and my van guys, I think a lot of these are the driving forces. You know, these guys are testing all this stuff because, shoot, I remember solar panels was something talked about when I was a kid. You know, they were around. You'd have the little things, the little solar calculators and stuff were coming out, and people thought that was cool. But the cost factor was so high that unless you were already wealthy and playing with it, you didn't touch it. Now you can go down to the local store and pick one up and hook it up to recharge your battery on your boat or your car or something, you know, just a simple one. So the cost has already dropped drastically on that. And it's, that part's fun to watch.
Absolutely. And this, you know, when I talk about these myths, Nate, it's not one-sided, right? And so when it comes to capitalism and or conservative values and environmental management going, you know, not being able to coexist, the same goes for those that believe capitalism is the total enemy. I mean, look what capitalism is doing for the cost of solar panels, right? Yes. Like people, businesses investing, innovations coming about, a competitive market is unfolding, reducing the cost, therefore increasing the uptake. It works. We've just got to, it's just about a progression. You know, we're changing, revolving as a society. And
something's funny in there is the guys that are complaining about capitalism are probably the same ones happy they can buy the cheaper solar panels so they don't have to use as much fossil fuel.
Exactly. Exactly. 100%. And so these are myths, right? So if we take what we know, I mean, capitalism is a very effective way for a community to operate. It allows people to achieve the best that they can be of themselves. It allows for people to grow and innovate and try different things, right? It creates. We grow as individuals. We grow as people. A very sound environmental argument is to say, this isn't about undoing capitalism. This is about simply changing the type of products we have within the mix, the type of services we have within the mix. And how does that happen? It happens through market forces. So how does that happen? It happens through education in the market. And so as people educate themselves more and from the environmental perspective, they start to demand these changes and we start to see the shift in the markets. So I guess where this leads me as well, Nate, is to say, well, when you think about what is being proposed for climate change mitigation, for me, individually, it doesn't sound that bad. If I think about a gradual transition away from fossil fuels into a world where we're dependent on electricity rather than hydrocarbons, I don't see that as a bad thing. I see less air pollution. You know, I talked to my father-in-law who grew up in LA in the 70s. He said he couldn't see across the street. And these days you can.
Right.
Because they decided to improve air quality. It's the same deal, right? So we can have an improved environment through these new products, and we can potentially have a more competitive market, and we can grow. So I look at that and go, well, grow through innovation. I look at that and go, is that really such a bad thing?
Well, it comes back to point of view, which if you take me being a diesel mechanic for 30 years, you know, it's like you're hitting my livelihood. I don't want to mess with the computer, you know.
Yeah.
You have to change and evolve, and it's getting more technical and stuff. And it's like even training other guys to turn wrenches and become mechanics. It's like you got to know how a basic engine works. If you don't know how a basic engine works, then you're not really a mechanic. You're a computer guy. But then you get these kids out of school that are computer guys, and they're like, well, yeah, I can run this fancy computer and tell you everything about this engine, but I can walk over and go, look, this wire's unplugged. What if we plug this back in? You know, and there's that big disconnect coming things, and I watched it evolve as the diesel engines grew and they started throwing more and more computers and sensors and everything on it. So I'm very entrenched on the diesel side. So I'm a grumbler. You know, I'm grumbling because I want my old school diesel engine where I turned a screw, it got more black smoke and we had more power. You know, those days went away. Or you have the argument with the guy, it's like, well, we used to let our engines just idle all the time. It was better for them. Yeah, you're absolutely right. In 1990s, it was better if we just let them idle and not turn them on and off. But come 2000s, that's all changed. Now, if you sit there and let it idle, clogs up all your exhaust systems and everything else. You have to change. You have to evolve, and you get those grumbling eras. So,
yeah, and I think part of the challenge with that, Nate, is the fact that we've left our run quite late now, and so this, you know, the whole this shift has been talked about for decades, and we're now at the point where we need to do it in a bit of a hurry.
Yes.
Now, if it was a 20 or 30 year transition, slowly moving and slowly evolving, you'd be able to ride out your career looking after diesel engines, and you'd be able to, you know, and then the new generation would come through with the new technology and things would be in balance.
Right.
But now we're in a bit of a hurry. And so I, you know, the change might be need to be fast. I don't know exactly, but from what I understand, from what I read, and I'm not a climate change expert, but we do need to move pretty quickly now in order to prevent what could be really bad. And this is the other side of the equation, is that it could be, I use those words very deliberately, really bad.
Bad.
Really bad. And so I look at that and go, you know, like as a man and thinking about the way I manage my life for my family, it could be really bad to move into a neighborhood with a really cheap home. It could be really bad. That could be really bad for me and my family. It could be really bad if I didn't have house insurance for the 1% chance my house might burn down. That would be really bad. So I invest in house insurance. So I invest in a home in a good area. That's the approach I take, right? I prepare. I manage uncertainty by capping the potential downside. Any good investor does that. I think about going down this pathway, what could go wrong? I love the Richard Branson example when he kicked off Virgin Air. He negotiated with Boeing. He said to them, I want to kick off an airline. I want to get a plane from you, and I want to negotiate terms where I can give it back at no cost if it doesn't work out. Cap the downside. That's the way I view this. I view this as a what-if scenario. It could be really bad. The consequences are really significant. That's what we're being told. The action is tough. It's difficult. It's hard. But it's not that bad. Like when I look, I get it. I get your example there. There are livelihoods at stake. I get that. But we can adjust. We can evolve. We can do new things. And it doesn't. I'm not sure it needs to be total and utter tearing apart of our economies, you know, tearing down everything that we know today and rebuilding from scratch such that people will be out there on food stamps. I don't see it being that significant. So when I look at it through a risk mindset and risk management, I immediately fall into the camp of actually whether or not it's actually human-induced climate change. And I'm in the camp where I believe that it is. I accept the science because there is a really high consensus, like 97 to 100% consensus among scientists around the world, that this is human-induced climate change. But that becomes less important when I'm thinking about the consequence, when I think about it through a risk mindset.
Here's a thought on that, because I come from the camp of, I think the Earth goes through cycles, you know, and that's just looking back, you know, we've had ice ages. We've had times the planet was hot. And this is where I think we could agree. I still think the Earth is just going through one of its cycles. It's getting warmer, drier, things are changing a little bit. But on the note of the science where you're going, okay, is humans are helping it along. Like, instead of, you know, it could say it could warm up, I don't know, a couple degrees average per year over the next 1,000 years, we're making it happen in the next 100 years. And then you have to make other changes faster. So to me, that's a negotiable point. I still think we're going into a cycle, but we're speeding up the cycle. So, and that's a what if scenario of if it's really that bad. I mean, when I was a kid, I had snow on the ground every year, you know, in the north, Illinois, Michigan area, Great Lakes. I had snow all the way to my birthday in April. You know, now it can be green till Christmas. All you got to do is look outside and go, and we're warming up, and it's like, okay, we're going through this cycle. Is it forced? So I think there's a little bit of – I am on the bubble. Part of it, I think it's just the Earth is spinning, and we're in part of that warming up cycle. And then on the other hand, we're helping it along, destroying things, because I've been to old garbage dumps, and I've seen polluted days, and I've seen the smog in the city, and I go, okay, that's a real concern. So it's both sides of it.
So yeah, I completely understand where you're coming from, and I too. So my background's ecology, so how different species work together in different within natural systems, right? That's always been my interest. And when I think about the way humans have operated over the years in relation to natural cycles of the Earth and other species have adjusted over the years, there's been time to change. There's been time to adapt. So it went from a warm era to a cool era to an ice age to a warm era. You know, species could move. You could migrate. You could change the location that you lived. You could change the food that you ate, because everything adjusted at the pace of nature, right? It had time to adjust through natural selection. It had time to adjust. What we're doing is what the science tells us is we're accelerating that pace. So there's two things. One, we're accelerating at a pace that won't allow for that adaptation to occur like it has in the past, because it's happening too quickly.
Okay.
So species won't be able to adapt as rapidly. They won't be able, and so our systems will be really thrown in turmoil. A great example is coral reefs. There's a lot of people don't realize that coral reefs are a living organism, and within them they have this coexistence. It's called a symbiotic relationship where two species will exist together and benefit from each other, a win-win scenario. They've got these plants that live inside them called zooxanthellae, and those plants photosynthesize like any plant does. And coral is dependent on those plants. Now, what happens as the ocean warms up is zooxanthellae actually leave the coral in a last-ditch effort to survive, and the coral dies as a result. So we're seeing, and that's called coral bleaching, where the coral goes from beautiful color to white.
All right.
Now, as soon as that happens, the coral stops growing, which means that you have less habitat for coral tropical species to live. The parrotfish don't have the coral to eat. You don't have as much habitat for different species to live. And what you also get is different algae will come in and start growing over the top of the coral. And as a result of that, you get a total change in the tropical reef system. Now, because if that had happened slowly, if that warming had happened slowly, different species of coral, which take thousands of years to grow, would be able to grow in place of the old coral, right? And so there are some corals that are fine with the warmer water. And so what scientists are now trying to do is literally pick up corals that are okay with it. First of all, they're going to go, what coral is okay with warm water? They've got to figure that out. Once they've figured that out, they've then got to pick them up and they've got to take them and they literally cement them in place in these bleached coral reefs to get them to grow. And then you've got to wait thousands of years for the coral to grow, to take over the system, to prevent that whole carnage from occurring. So under natural fluctuations, that would happen naturally. But because we're topping all of the CO2 emission and the greenhouse gas emissions, because it's not just CO2 here, you know, you've got nitrous oxide, you've got methane, even water vapor, you know, you've got a lot of greenhouse gases. Because we are putting them into the atmosphere, we're topping it up. And so the rate of change is happening faster than it has in the past. So that's an issue. So that's the first thing. The second thing is it accumulates. So year on, just like a bank account, year on year on year on year on year. And so when we look at the trajectory that we're on right now, if we keep on this trajectory, we do far surpass what it is that we've had in any natural events that have occurred. To the point, and this is what I always come back to, actually, this is more of a human problem than it is a nature problem. It is nature that is changing, but it's us that are impacted. It's humans that are going to have to leave the coastlines because of inundation from sea level. It's humans that are going to have to deal with more wildfires, more storms, et cetera, et cetera. So, look, you're right. Nature fluctuates. Everything adapts with it. What we're doing is making it happen faster so things can't adapt as rapidly as they would have in the past or as easily as they would have in the past.
So natural selection is coming back.
Well, it's always been there.
Been here, or I should say, it's natural selection is speeding up. Let's say that, like it's cleaning the West Coast right now, you know, of the United States. Yeah. We're hearing all the, you know, it's like, oh, we're gonna take care of this. You know, it has its own way of balancing itself out. Will we leave? Looking at the nature side, will we lose species because of it? Will we lose whole herds of animals and everything? More than likely, but then. Over time, we're going to get different species and different animals, or others will move into it. And nature has.
So the question is, what's harder?
That is a good question,
right? Is it harder to take a bit of action now to adjust now to allow that to happen over an elongated period of time, so our kids and grandkids and great grandkids are able to adjust slowly, and animals are able? Is that harder than not doing anything and having them deal with having to do it in a hurry? Like, I would rather relocate a city across 100 years or 200 years. Yes.
Than all at once. 30.
Yeah. So what's harder? And again, when I think about this in my own perspective, my own life, I'm like, I'm going to put in the work. I'm going to step up as a man and say, I'm going to do what I need to do here. I'm going to take responsibility for the circumstance. I'm going to own the circumstance. I'm going to take a conservative viewpoint. I'm going to risk manage, and I'm going to actively seek to ensure that others are going to benefit from my work. And I guess when you start to adopt that mindset, that the decisions become pretty easy.
And then this stay on this train, and this is something you kick back. Is taking this mindset, this risk management, and moving it into other parts of our lives.
Yeah.
How would you, like, what's some simple things that you think you could apply the same thing to? Beyond just like our greenhouse effect or just this, just in our daily lives, how can people start thinking in these terms? Because there's one of the biggest things, you know, you get into the conversations and it's a world problem. You know, it's the nation's problem. It's how can, a lot of times you got to micro it down to the person. what can the person do? What can they do to adjust their daily in their daily lives to adjust things?
Okay. So yeah, real cool. Good question. So I think the first thing that people can do is if they're willing, take the advancement within their discussions to say climate change could be caused by humans. Perhaps we should do something about it, right? Like just accept that it could be. And because, like I say, you've got hundreds of thousands of scientists around the world, and many of the big businesses in the world now saying it's human-induced, we're going to do something about it. So you kind of go, okay, it could be. It could be. I'm not a scientist. I haven't interrogated all the data. There's this guy over here who says it's not. There's this guy over here, all these thousands over here that say it is. I'm not going to spend my life delving into it. I'm not going to get a PhD in the science to determine for myself. So I'm simply going to say it could be. And if it is, it could be really bad. And so maybe we should do something about it. Like that's the first thing that I think people could do. Then I think what would the approach that myself and my wife take with our lives is we seek to find change in our life that has multiple benefits. So I think I saw on FOE, someone talked about chunking, where you bring together multiple tasks, right? And you do them one hit, right? And during our session on, I think, the days of yore, people were talking about getting out and about and doing more things, you know? One of the things that I've changed in my life is I ride a bike into work now. And the primary reason that I ride a bike into work is because I get exercise. So I've now chunked my commute with my exercise. So I ride 10Ks in and 10Ks out, and I do that twice a week on my cardio days. So that's awesome. I've now got exercise. As a result, I've also reduced my costs because I don't have to pay for fuel and I don't have to pay for parking. And I've also reduced my carbon footprint because I'm not utilizing greenhouse gases in order to get there. So start to think in those terms. And as an ecologist, I tend to believe if we're operating in a way that is good for us as humans, as just another member of our global community of all the other animals and plants and species, right? If we do what's good for us, truly, then we're probably going to be doing what's good for the world as well. People talk about eating whole foods. People talk about eating organic foods, right? People talk about minimizing their red meat intake. And that people are having these discussions for health reasons. Like Coop talks about not eating red meat. He's like, oh, I just can't go there. It's not good for me. I know others would debate that. But
yes.
But me being one, I love my red meat, but that's him. That's what's right for him.
Right.
So what's right for others? I think about eating seafood when you're, I don't know, 1,000 miles from the ocean. Probably not the freshest food in the world, right?
No.
So maybe leave the seafood to the people on the coast. And then we wouldn't be taking so much fish out of the ocean. So it's like just thinking about things through a, what am I doing and how can it have multiple benefits? I think would improve the world massively. Even just getting out of our cars and walking, for crying out loud. I think someone was talking about someone being half a mile from school and they still pick their kids up in a car. Mm-hmm. Come on. Like the kids could walk home. And wouldn't that be great for them? Because they climb a tree on the way, they'd spend time with their friends, they'd get some exercise and fresh air, and we wouldn't be utilizing as many hydrocarbons. So I think it's just about looking at the world through a different lens, if you like. Sometimes you could, you know, even if you looked at it from a financial perspective, utilizing less fuel means less cost. That's a good thing. You sail. Maybe using a sailboat rather than a speedboat. You still get your pleasure of being out on the water.
Water, right.
You know, so it's just about little adjustments. You know, we feel like we've got a relatively low impact life, but we still drink milk. We still eat red meat. We still go on holidays. I've still got a caravan that I hitch up and take my kids to the beach. But we just along the way, we try to be a bit more, the word people use, and I hesitate to use it because it's often associated with liberal activists is being a bit more conscious.
Okay.
And I utilize that term because it's about being thinking actively and being deliberate in your actions.
Right.
And look, then I think if I was to say one thing that we could all do that would be massively beneficial for the environment is try to eliminate our plastic use. Like plastic is just, we are swimming in it.
Right.
And you just have the photos of Asia and the amount of plastic that's washing up on the beaches, and being a marine ecologist, hearing about whales washing up on beaches and their guts are full of plastics and birds are dying because their guts are full of plastics. And it's just like, we're just trashing this place. And it is our responsibility to, we love the great outdoors. So let's try and keep it pure. Let's try and keep nature natural. And we can do that by trying to eliminate single-use plastics out of our life as much as we can. And again, there's an economic benefit there.
Right.
You know, like you don't buy as much junk. One thing we've done with our kids now for their birthdays, we'd have a birthday party and everyone would come along and the parents would go, oh, I've got to buy a birthday present. So they'd race to the shop and they'd buy a $10 or $15 toy that would get used three times by kids and then chucked in a box. So we said to the kids, we're not doing that anymore. You guys are going to raise some money for a good cause. And so we set up a like a give a little page for a water fund. These people were going to places in Africa and providing water sources for communities that had no water. And our kids went along to school and they said to their friends, don't get me a present, just get your parents to donate to this fund. And then they watched the fund grow and they learned that they could raise money for this good cause and there was no plastic. So there's all, I don't know, there's all sorts of things, Nate. It's just about changing our mindset a little and not buying into, not, and again, I this is a fraternity of excellence mindset. We don't need junk in our lives, you know? Right. We can just be a bit more deliberate and a bit more careful, a bit more minimalistic about our lives and think about how we can make everything we do better. And if we did that rather than just cruising with the mainstream, we'd make a massive difference.
It's making those little gradual changes. One thing here, one thing there, instead of doing it quick, just like anything, do it a little bit over time and then it just becomes a normal, just becomes a habit. And it grows from there. So absolutely. I think that's a good spot to stop on. This has been a fun conversation. I learned a few things along the way. So
yeah, no, I've enjoyed it. Thanks for having me, Nate. I really appreciate you opening yourself up to having the conversation. I know it's not necessarily one that everyone wants to have. So I really appreciate it.
No, it was enjoyable. And it comes back down to education. You know, depending on which side you're looking at it from, what viewpoint you're looking, so much just comes down to being educated on it. And I'm not talking going to school or anything. It's just, here's some of the facts. Look at both sides of it. You know, see the whole story. Sit down and have a discussion, not a emotional yelling match of obscenities that everyone's like looking at him going, huh?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's it. That's it, mate. Eliminate the emotion and be a bit more level-headed about it.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me, Mark.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.